Good morning and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. Our guest today is award-winning journalist Ben Ehrenreich. He first traveled to the occupied West Bank in 2011 on assignment for Harper's Magazine, and then a year later he went back on assignment for the New York Times Magazine. And then he returned again in 2013. That visit lasted long enough that he was able to travel to the West Bank and live among and talk to Palestinians and their families about the complexities of life under occupation. That experience led him to write a new book. It's entitled The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. The book very, very vividly documents the daily demonstrations, night raids, detentions, home demolitions, the full breadth of experience in the West Bank. But of course, he says that any book about this region is bound to stir some controversy, and he admits that this one probably will too. He says what he's trying to do in writing it is correct an imbalance of longstanding, one that he says has exacted far too many lives. He's an award-winning journalist, author of two novels entitled Ether and The Suitors, and he's here today to talk about his latest offering, The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. He joins us from Studio City Sounds in Los Angeles. Welcome to the program, Ben.
Good morning, Renee. It's great to be here.
Thank you. And of course, once again, this is one of those subjects that whenever you bring it up, people have deep-seated feelings about the conflict. So we want to invite people right off the top. Give us a call, 866-798-8255, or you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Ben, congratulations. I've read the entire book. Very engaging and very provocative. And before we dive in and talk about your reporting and why you decided to write the book, would you mind by starting out by reading just a passage from your book to get us started?
Sure, of course. I'll read a passage from the very beginning. I arrived in Ramallah for the first time on March 15th, 2011. Nowhere else in the Middle East had the oppression and violence seemed so intractable for so long. The worst days of the Second Intifada had ended several years before, but nothing whatsoever had been resolved. Peace talks between Israel and the Palestinian Authority had collapsed in 2010. Only the Americans seemed to mourn them. To most Palestinians, the previous 20 years of on-again, off-again negotiations had been one long charade, a glitzy show for the cameras that served mainly to hide the grinding and ever-escalating humiliations of life under occupation. What Israelis experienced as relative calm, Palestinians lived out as a slow and steady exercise in annexation. More settlements, more prisoners, more evictions and home demolitions, more land loss to the path of the wall. The number of Israeli settlers living in the West Bank had more than tripled since the first Oslo Agreement was signed in 1993. Assaults on Palestinians by soldiers at checkpoints or by settlers anywhere else were so common that they rarely made the news. But things were changing. Elsewhere, entire populations were taking to the streets. Tyrannies that had seemed destined to last forever were collapsing left and right. The air seemed crisp and clear. Palestine had seen major uprisings in each of the two previous decades. Surely, if it could happen in the comparatively placid climes of the Maghreb and the Gulf, Palestine would not be long in rising up.
So clearly, Ben, your perhaps the choice of your title has a reference to the spring, the way to the spring. Does your title indicate that you were looking at the potential for the Arab Spring to engage Palestinians as well?
Sure. I mean, it was certainly something that was on people's minds while I was there. I think by the time I moved to Ramallah, which was about 3 years ago this month, in 2013, a lot of that optimism had become a lot more sober. You know, things had Syria was beginning to collapse. At that point, in Egypt, the Islamic Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, was in charge. In Libya, things were a mess. So there wasn't the same intense optimism. But there was a sense, as I think there has been in the West Bank for a very long time, that the situation couldn't be sustained. It's a place where things always seem like they're about to change, like things are so awful and so tense that they can't last. But regrettably, they do seem to continue to stay the same.
Well, certainly the timing of your being there, you first traveled there in 2011 and again in 12, and then decided to spend the year 2013 to 14 in the West Bank. Do you feel like you took off your journalist's hat during that time in your decision to immerse yourself in the social fabric of the West Bank and live among Palestinian families and tell the stories through their eyes?
No, I think I was wearing that hat quite firmly. I think that's what good journalism does, is it tries to, you know, find stories that aren't being told and tell them.
Well, even in your prologue, in your introduction, you clearly say you're not offering an objective representation of the people and the place. What you say is you're looking for truth, and if there has been criticism, that's what it is. One reviewer in an online book site says the book isn't balanced or objective from multiple points of view, very little discussion with any Israelis, something the author points out in the introduction. So you're getting one side of the story throughout, and since you know that going in, you can draw your own conclusions based on the stories and the reporting. And a reviewer, Steve Weinberg from the Minneapolis Star Tribune, says, I wish he'd provided more materials from Israelis, but as a reviewer, I must accept his decision to write the book he chose to write to alleviate what he perceives as an imbalance. What imbalance do you perceive?
Well, you know, when I first started working in the West Bank, I was powerfully struck that the stories that I was hearing everywhere, that the things I was seeing everywhere, that the realities that I was experiencing are simply not reported in the U.S. in the mainstream media. We simply don't get them. And as much rhetoric as there is about balance in this country, what we mainly get is an Israeli perspective and Israeli stories. When we do hear about Palestinians, and this is a generalization, but I think it's pretty true, we either hear about them as terrorists or as corpses. They're either victims or they're monsters. And we don't get much in between. When one does try to tell Palestinian stories, suddenly then there tends to be a giant call for balance. And what that usually means is that we need Israeli perspectives to counterbalance the Palestinian perspectives. And this doesn't ever happen the other way. Book after book has been written from an entirely Israeli perspective, and we don't hear these same calls, wait, we need to have a Palestinian point of view to balance this. So, you know, what I set out to do from the very beginning was, given that so much of this conflict had been reported on from an entirely Israeli perspective, to try to expose people to the side that they weren't hearing.
Well, this conversation is fraught. I'm sure I don't have to tell you. Just there are signals. If you go to visit, do you stay in East Jerusalem or West Jerusalem? Even referring to it as Palestine is making a political statement. So I don't think there is any topic in the U.S. that's as contentious as this discussion. So as a journalist, were you concerned how it would be received by the audience to whom you were hoping to reach out?
Yeah, you know, writing about these issues, one knows that it's going to be contentious. One knows that people are going to come to this with very powerfully established perspectives that they feel really strongly about. And, you know, so what I tried to do while reporting this, what I tried to do while writing this, was to do so with an open mind and an open heart, and to hope that I can meet readers in that place as well, and that whatever their opinions are and however they've come to them about this conflict, that readers will go into this book with a certain degree of openness and allow themselves to whatever they think before they start reading the book, whatever they think at the end of the book, will allow themselves to consider perspectives and experiences that they haven't had a chance to consider.
I thought it was interesting that you chose to do it literally from the homes and villages of Palestinians. You focus on three places, the village of Nabi Saleh, which is a very small village, population about 500, and the people in this first village have been protesting every week, every single week, since the year 2009 for the right to use a spring for a valuable resource in this area. Water is critical, and they have been protesting weekly since 2009 to use their spring and their land, which has now been taken over by Israeli settlers. So let's start by talking about that particular village and why you chose to focus on that one.
Yeah, I mean, I first went to Nabi Saleh in 2011 when I was interested in water, because I'd heard about this village where a spring had been confiscated by settlers, where they'd begun these protests to try to get it back. And I went there and for one afternoon on that trip and was sufficiently interested by what I saw that I ended up pitching a story to the New York Times Magazine and going back and staying there for weeks longer. And I think what originally really caught my attention and I found interesting and compelling about Nabi Saleh was, as you said, it's a tiny village, and every Friday they would attempt to march to this spring, and every Friday, with a single exception that I can think of, one day when they actually made it to the spring, every Friday Israeli soldiers would meet them as they set out and meet them with tear gas, meet them with rubber-coated steel bullets, meet them sometimes with live ammunition. The soldiers would come back during the week, and they would raid the village, and they would arrest people. It was a village that even then was paying this enormous cost for their decision to resist the occupation, and as the years would go on, would pay a still greater cost. Two young men for the village, Mustafa Tamimi and Rusty Tamimi, would be killed. Mustafa was shot in the face with a tear gas canister at very short distance, and Rusty Tamimi was shot in the back with a bullet from an M16 by an Israeli soldier on a hillside outside the village. In addition to that, many people from the village would be arrested, would go to prison, sometimes for short spells, sometimes for long spells, and yet they kept going back every Friday. All they would have had to do to simply suffer the kind of normal degree of humiliations and difficulties that the occupation imposes on people would have been to stop demonstrating. But they didn't. They kept at it. And I was really both moved by that and puzzled by that and fascinated by that. What was it that kept these people going against an opponent that was so much stronger than them, and which they really seemed to have no chance of being able to defeat? And what kept that kind of resistance going? And that's what I ended up really looking into in those sections.
And what did you find was animating them?
Well, I think a certainty that if they didn't fight, no one else would. I think they felt a deep obligation to keep this struggle going, and to try to bring it to the attention of the world. I think in Nabi Saleh, their strategy, they didn't really believe they were going to be able to take their land back from the soldiers who guarded it every week. But they did think that by continuing to do this, they could bring the world's attention to the fight they were fighting. And in that, I think they've been remarkably successful.
Well, their experience in terms of dealing with settlements was not unique. But if you can, just explain the extent to which the expansion of settlements has changed the physical spaces in the place you've visited.
Sure. I mean, the first time I traveled to the West Bank was quite a long time ago. It was before the Second Intifada. I was there just as a visiting friends in Israel as a tourist in 1997. And in those days, one could drive, you know, from Jerusalem into the West Bank without thinking much of it. And there were these beautiful rolling hills and Palestinian villages nestled in the hills. When I went back in 2011, I was really shocked by how much it changed, not just by the wall, which is this, you know, concrete scar across the landscape, and not just by the checkpoints, which prevent movement from, at various points throughout the West Bank, not only between Israel and the West Bank, but between different parts of the West Bank. But almost every hillside in large sections of the West Bank is covered by an Israeli settlement, which look a lot like Southern California subdivisions. I mean, you know, usually white stone buildings with red roofs, usually surrounded by perimeter fences, usually with an Israeli military base on an adjacent hillside. And they've really managed to take over large parts of the landmass of the West Bank. And it's very difficult, I must say, if you spend any time in the West Bank, to conceive of the kind of solution, the kind of political solution that the U.S. has been pushing for for all these years. There's now as many as 500,000 settlers in the West Bank. This is a population which is not going to leave anytime soon. And yet, over these decades, while Israel has been giving lip service to the two-state solution and to the negotiations process, they have been allowing these settlements to continue to grow and expand and deepen their presence on Palestinian territory.
Ben, I imagine there are folks listening who have paid visits to Israel, the West Bank, Palestine, and have seen the areas that you're talking about. But I imagine that the landscape has changed markedly. I was there in 1998, and then again in the aughts, and it was interesting to see the differences. And I want to invite our callers. Have you been? Have you seen? What were your thoughts? Give us a call, 866-798-8255. Email us at feedback@yourcall.org. And Ben has insights that most of us will never have about the impact, the human impact of this conflict that we hear so much about with very little context on news. So let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Lisa, Ben's waiting to hear your thoughts. I'm sorry, the audio is very, very low, so I'm not able to hear you, Lisa. Let's try and work that out and come back. So, Ben, you were talking about the settlers. So I must say, on my first visit there, I don't know why I had this idea that settlers were somehow temporary and settlements were temporary, that this was somehow a bridge of accommodation. But I was surprised at what seemed to be the permanence by design, the permanence of settlements, and the fact that despite ongoing negotiations for a two-state solution, the settlements are even now continuing to be built. So what does that say for a potential for a solution to this?
Yeah, they certainly do not consider themselves temporary, and I think for any Israeli politician to suggest as much would be at this point political suicide, given the political climate in Israel. Just in 2016 alone, the land confiscations, which means confiscations of Palestinian land by the Israeli government, have increased so much. There's been, in the first 3 months of 2016, as much land as has been confiscated as in all of 2015. So if anything, the Netanyahu government is picking up the pace of land confiscation and settlement expansion. And yeah, I think it's an excellent question. It's very difficult to imagine that the kind of solution that has been discussed for decades now, an independent Palestinian state next to an independent, Jewish Israeli state, it's harder and harder to imagine as there's a larger Israeli population within the bounds of the West Bank.
And there's not much that would compel a change in approach, is there?
Certainly not from within Israel. At the moment, there are Palestinian struggles like the one in Nabi Saleh, but they're quite small and at the moment quite isolated. In Israel, all forces that would argue against settlement expansion have really been marginalized as Israeli society has moved to the right. I think the one source of hope and for me of real optimism at the moment is in the United States. You know, the fact that you and I are having this discussion on the radio right now, the fact that this book is coming out right now, the fact that Bernie Sanders has in his campaign started to talk in a very, you know, I think a very modest way about the necessity of talking about Palestinian rights when we think about a solution to this problem suggests that the conversation in this country is starting to open up. For years, there wasn't much of a conversation at all. And I think people are really hungry for one here. And I think given that the U.S. supports Israel to the tune of $3.1 billion a year in military aid, what we believe here and what we how our beliefs are reflected in the actions of our elected representatives can have a huge impact on what goes on there. We have an enormous amount of power and leverage over the decisions the Israeli government makes that we have not been using for decades as we've been supporting them no matter what they've been doing.
Interestingly enough, in the case of Nabi Saleh, even the Palestinian Authority was asking them to limit their protests. So any resistance was being throttled back to some extent. So it's interesting that that is now perhaps turning around in terms of pressure, yes?
Well, no. You know, I think actually we have a for the most part, I think we have an incorrect view of the function of the Palestinian Authority from the U.S. I think we tend to view the Palestinian Authority and Israel as these sort of enemies. I think when you spend much time in the West Bank, it's fairly clear that the Palestinian Authority works quite closely with the Israeli government. They are involved in constant security coordination. And one of the main things that the – and by security coordination, what I mean is that when Israeli troops come into the West various parts of the West Bank, they tell the Palestinian Authority so the Palestinian Authority can pull their troops away so there are no conflicts and the Israelis can raid and do arrests and whatever they need to do without any interference. But the Palestinian Authority has – one of its main functions has been to repress resistance against the Israeli occupation in various forms, whether that's demonstrations in some of the small villages, to larger demonstrations in the cities, to you know, things like arresting Hamas members, which they do very regularly.
I think hearing your version of the Palestinian Authority's role will come as a surprise to a lot of people. It certainly does to me. That there's a relationship between the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority.
Yeah, you know, I think certainly the Israeli government and Netanyahu frequently portrays the Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Prime Minister, as an inciter of violence, as a sort of prime enemy. But the fact is that the PA is the main force standing in the way of a more powerful and widespread resistance to the occupation. I don't think there's many Palestinians in the West Bank who would disagree with that.
We're talking to Ben Ehrenreich. He's the author of a new book. And I want to get to Lisa's call. We have her back and your calls as well. Give us a call, 866-798-8255. We're talking to Ben Ehrenreich, and we'll talk about the Oslo Agreement. Did that make any difference at all? And about the other villages that he lived in and came to understand in his experiences. So we hope you'll stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's program. Coming up in a half an hour, it is World Have Your Say from the BBC. They'll be talking about the shootings in Orlando. They'll also be talking about Britain's ongoing conversation as to whether they're going to stay or go, leave the European Union. World Have Your Say from the BBC coming up in a half an hour at 11 o'clock here on KALW San Francisco.
Welcome back. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today on Your Call. And if you're listening in, we hope that you'll give us a call. This is one of those subjects where you have so very little insight from the inside of this conflict. We hear about it in the news when there are flare-ups, but this is an insight from Ben Ehrenreich because he lived in the occupied territories, and he has views that only someone from the inside can have. So give us a call, 866-798-8255. Tomorrow, we're going to have a conversation about Lyme disease. It's transmitted through ticks. 300,000 Americans diagnosed every year. Some experts say close to a million. Untreated, it can lead to everything from a rash to blindness to paralysis. But how much is known about it? What's the best way to treat it? And now that summer is coming, how can you avoid becoming infected? That's on tomorrow's Your Call. We want to hear from you. What is the power of stories to bring people together? Ben Ehrenreich, author of The Way to the Spring, is hoping that through stories we'll better understand this longstanding conflict. So thanks for joining us, Ben. Let's go to Lisa. Lisa, thanks for hanging in there.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much, Ben, for publishing such an important book, which is definitely lopsided in favor of Israeli perspectives. And I just want to mention that recently I just found out that the Israel was voted by UN as part of to head the one of the six major committees. This one was called the one that's dealing with law, international law, which seems very inappropriate to say the least, because even though the United States likes to portray Israel as being the only democracy in the Middle East, in fact, even within Israel, Arab citizens, Palestinian citizens of Israel are subjected to apartheid. There are different laws for different groups, and specifically favoring the Jewish citizens, including the issue of the right of return. In essence, if a Palestinian marries a Jewish citizen, they cannot go and live in Israel. There are rules regarding ownership of property. There are separate rules regarding punishments for same crimes. It is apartheid, and there's a website called itisapartheid.org, which people can look at specifically the hundreds of different regulations within Israel. So I see very difficult situations, because on the one hand, the Palestinians are being prevented from having their own homeland, but at the same time, even one homeland with civil rights, that seems far away as well. With equality under the law, seems far away as well.
Ben, even former President Jimmy Carter was castigated for referring to the wall that was being constructed as being an apartheid wall. So the language itself evokes a certain amount of concern among some folks. What do you think?
Yeah, it does, and thank you, Lisa, for those comments. I think you're right, and it's hard to understand from a distance that when we talk about the occupation, we're not just talking about the presence of Israeli troops on Palestinian territory, but we're talking about a very complex system, which are actually several interlocking systems, and one of those is a legal system. And as Lisa mentioned, there are two completely distinct legal systems for Palestinians who live in the West Bank and for Israelis. So if an Israeli settler throws a rock at someone in the West Bank, he will be arrested by Israeli police and charged in the Israeli criminal justice system, will have various due process rights that would be familiar to us in the United States. If a Palestinian is arrested for the same crime in the same place, he won't be arrested by the police. He'll be arrested by the Israeli army and brought to a military prison and tried in a military court. In the Israeli military court system, the conviction rate for Palestinians is over 99%, and none of those due process rights will be relevant. There are two completely parallel systems. Israelis and Palestinians can live literally side by side, but live vastly different lives in terms of access to resources, in terms of civil rights, in terms of every single aspect of life. As Lisa mentioned, things as intimate as the right to marry. I think the law she was referring to, which was just renewed by the Knesset, is a law which prevents Palestinian West Banker residents of the West Bank who marry Israelis still cannot get Israeli citizenship or residency. If I or any of our listeners who are not Palestinian were to marry an Israeli citizen, we would be given automatic residency. But a Palestinian who lives in the West Bank right there does not have those same rights. So the occupation just functions in these absolutely dizzying ways that regulate all aspects of Palestinian life.
All right, let's go to Aurora in Palo Alto. Good morning.
Morning. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Go right ahead.
Hey, Ben, thanks for writing this book. As Lisa already has said, Palestinians are not treated as equal, and they are treated as kind of subhuman over there. So, I mean, that's a well-known fact. But my question is, why does moral bankruptcy of this whole system is well evident? But the thing I don't understand is, why did U.S. support Israel blindly, and what's causing that relationship to kind of fall a little bit, becoming a little bit not as warm as it was before?
Yeah, I think for years, from 1967 on, when the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and the Golan began, at that time there were Cold War geopolitical reasons for the U.S. supporting Israel. We wanted someone who was an ally who was friendly to us, and there was no chance they'd go over to the Soviets. I think in recent years, in the context of the war against terror, the U.S. has been very happy to have a military ally in the region that is, stands firmly against whatever it is we're fighting in the war against terror, which is not always clear. But I think what's been happening in the last few years is Israel has become more and more right-wing. The occupation has become more and more entrenched. The siege on Gaza has become more and more brutal and involves not only cutting Gaza off and really literally starving people out, but bombing them periodically. So every 2 years or so, there's been a war where Israel has to, as the Israeli military puts it, mow the lawn. And in the last one, 2,200 people were killed. And the one before that, 1,400 people were killed. And I think from the U.S. and the rest of the world, it's harder and harder to watch these things and have unambivalent feelings about Israel as our great ally in the region, which is a force for stability in the region. I mean, I think this occupation has been actually a major cause of instability in the region for many, many years and remains that way. But I think in the last few years, particularly as Israeli society has moved farther and farther to the right, I think a wedge has opened up between a lot of Israel's supporters in the U.S., many of whom are Democrats and who have, progressive politics other than their support of Israel, and are having a harder and harder time reconciling their values with the kinds of injustice and systematic inequality that they see in Israel and the occupied territories.
Ben, just last week there were attacks in Tel Aviv, left 4 people dead. And I'm wondering, especially given our recent experience in Orlando, is there a concern? Because when there is that kind of knife attack or shooting or lone wolf, even using vehicles in these lone wolf attacks in Israel, I'm wondering, do you get concerned about whether the kind of support that you're starting to see in the United States gets undermined when the United States homeland is attacked?
I mean, I think a lot of the support for Israel in this country has had to do with that kind of identification, especially since September 11th of 2001. I think Israel was happy to say to the U.S., look, we have all this experience with terrorism, too. We're suffering the same thing. We're fighting against the same enemies. But I think that's frankly not true. I think the situation in Israel is you know, the fact of the violence there, it's quite easy to figure out why there's violence. It's quite easy to figure out why there are these attacks. It's because there is an occupation. And as awful as that violence is, there's awful violence on both sides. And until that stops and until the situation of occupation and inequality and justice ends, we're going to keep seeing violence.
Okay, let's go to Richard in Stinson Beach. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. I have noticed, it's hard to miss this, several times in the past few years, people have spoken out about the situation in Israel and defended or even tried to establish the facts around the occupation, and they have been shut up. Subsequently, I will list 3 of them. I'm sure you can think of many more. Jimmy Carter, who, of course, notably called apartheid on the Israelis, and withdrew. He retracted his statement and he disappeared from the subject. The New York Film Jewish Film Festival, I think it was scheduled to show a film on Rachel Corrie, which was suppressed. Not only suppressed, they pulled the film from showing it, but the management came up with some justification for it that did not strike me or most people as sensible. It didn't seem consistent. The third thing I would mention was the Goldstone report at the UN. So this goes internationally. Goldstone, of course, is South African. His criticism, the criticism of the report, which was totally substantiated, was ultimately compromised by Goldstone's ultimate withdrawal of his support and endorsement of it. Though I know his withdrawal was partial, and he equivocated a bit about it. He did it. My question is this. What do you think makes the efforts to suppress this information so successful, even against people who want to speak out against it, about the truth? It can't just be threats of you'll lose your job, we'll campaign against you, or any. There has to be something more effective going on with all these people. I'm just asking if your guest has any thoughts on the matter. Thank you.
Thank you. No, you know, and I would add to that, in recent months, it hasn't just been people on the left. I'm not sure if we want to count Jimmy Carter on the left, but yeah, I suppose he is, who've been making these kinds of criticisms and then taking a lot of heat for them. Just a few weeks ago, Yair Golan, who's who is the second highest ranked officer in the Israeli military, made comments in which he expressed concern that the current political climate in Israel, in which open racism is more or less everywhere, he compared this to the situation in Germany in the 1930s, which is an extremely strong analogy to make, which touches just about every button there is. And clearly he knew what he was doing, and he thought this was important to say. He was roundly attacked and had to back away from those comments. So, you know, it's not just people on the left anymore. I think even people who are fairly hawkish and right-wing people inside of Israel who have a pragmatic sense of where their country is going are getting quite concerned about the situation. And why this is, there is a powerful and well-organized social media effort on the part of the Israeli government, both the military and the government itself, to silence and marginalized voices that are critical of Israel. I think in the U.S. too, a lot of people are nervous. This is a topic that people have extremely strong feelings about. And it's a conversation a lot of people don't want to have because they don't want to arouse that kind of anger.
I have a hunch you don't get a lot of attaboys for this subject, Ben, but we just got one in an email from a 73-year-old woman. She says, I am a 73-year-old Jewish woman. Please tell Ben Ehrenreich thank you for me. He is a credit to his wonderful mother.
That's very nice.
Yeah, I imagine you don't get much of that. How much pushback have you received?
Actually, you know, you'd be surprised. I've been surprised. The first time I wrote in a really, you know, major mainstream publication about this was in the New York Times Magazine. That article came out in 2013. It was an article about Nabi Saleh. I was steeling myself to be attacked and smeared and was quite happy. I got a lot of hate mail. My editors got hate mail. I certainly was attacked on Twitter and on social media. But far more than I got emails attacking me, I got emails from people like the person who just wrote in thanking me, saying nobody has – you're thanking me for saying the things they'd been thinking but that they weren't hearing in the mainstream media. And I think those voices are out there. There is a very strong and growing part of American public opinion which wants to hear a different perspective on these issues, which is not convinced that the stories they've been hearing over and over again for years have any truth to them, which is horrified by the repeated massacres in Gaza and by the constant injustice in the West Bank, and that wants to see a different kind of conversation going on, and that is excited to actually talk about this in a new way.
We're talking to Ben Ehrenreich, author of The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. He's going to be at City Lights Bookstore on Thursday in San Francisco, and he's joining us to talk about his new book, The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. We invite your calls, 866-798-8255. Ben, we've talked about the village of Nabi Saleh, but you also visited Hebron, the only city in the West Bank where settlers have what appears to be a permanent presence, and also al-Kir in the South Hebron Hills, a Bedouin community. What were your experiences there, and how did you choose those locations, and how are settlements changing the political geography in those areas?
Well, I'll start by talking about Hebron. I'd been to Hebron in 2011, and it just twisted my head. I could not understand or believe what I was seeing the first time I was there. And I think anyone who's been there has probably had a pretty similar experience. As you mentioned, it's the only city in the West Bank that has the presence of Israeli settlers inside the city itself. In 1968, almost immediately after the occupation began, a group of very hardline settlers established themselves in the commercial center of Hebron, and they have been there since. Their presence has been expanding, and they are guarded there by a large contingent of Israeli soldiers. And what's been happening since the early 2000s is larger and larger parts of what was once the vibrant core of Hebron have been closed off to Palestinian residents. And by closed off, I mean streets where every single once busy commercial streets, where every shop front is closed and welded shut. Streets where Palestinians are not allowed to walk. What had been major streets in the city where Palestinians are not allowed to go at all. So a sort of ghost town has been constructed at the very center of Hebron. And through all of these parts, settlers can walk freely. Settlers can drive their cars. They can walk. But Palestinians who live there and whose families have been living there for many generations cannot. And it's an absolutely dizzying place with checkpoint after checkpoint that in the end, to really kind of get a hold on it and understand it and figure out how to think and talk about it, I ended up having to think in terms of science fiction books I'd read more than any kind of any political analysis I read, because it's such a a strange and unearthly place. In the book, I call it Planet Hebron, because it does in many ways seem so far from here. And it's a place of great and constant and awful violence during this most recent outbreak of violence that we've seen since October. Many of the deaths have occurred in Hebron. A place that where I just visited at the end of this last month, and found that yet another section of the city had been closed off to Palestinians that had been open to them when I'd been staying there in 2013. So there's a couple chapters about Hebron with a lot of very strange and painful stories, I should say. Some of them hopefully funny in a dark kind of way as well. And then the other place that I spent a lot of time is a tiny Bedouin village called Umm el-Khair, which is in the hills south of Hebron, which is the driest and poorest and most rural part of the West Bank. It's a Bedouin village. The people who live there fled from their ancestral lands inside of Israel after the 1948 war into the West Bank, which was then part of Jordan, and bought this hillside. Since then, as happens in most parts of the West Bank, a settlement was established on their lands, a settlement in this case called Carmel, which has been slowly expanding in ways that make their lives unlivable, taking over their agricultural lands, taking over the lands on which they graze their animals. The Bedouins are herding people. And in some of the villages nearby, there have been much more dramatic incidents of constant violence of settlers against Palestinians. There's been some violence in Umm el-Khair. But the reason I wanted to write about it was because it was actually the less spectacular sort of violence that was most prevalent there, this sort of slow squeeze, which through home demolitions, through the seizure of land over many years, the way that the people live there has become less and less viable and more difficult. Most recently, there were home demolitions there in April. Six homes. When I say it's a tiny village, it's about 100 people. Six homes that provided shelter for 35 people were demolished by Israeli bulldozers early one morning in April. When I visited last month, they were just putting the finishing touches on houses in the settlement next door. So this kind of contrast is something you always see there, that the settlements are constantly expanding. There are very few checks on construction and settlements. And meanwhile, in this absolutely impoverished community right next door, people are being deprived of what little shelter they have.
You know, I was actually there in Ramallah at a time when a home was being demolished. And you hear about home demolitions, but I was actually literally there as it was still smoldering and we were standing on the ruins. And, you know, you talk about something that's tragic and yet you have a good memory. I was literally brought tea in the middle of these ruins. So it was very poignant for me. But just briefly, if you would, because we do have a caller and I want to make sure we have time, just talk about home demolition as a form of collective punishment.
Sure. I mean, in Umm el-Khair, the demolitions occurred because the structures were unpermitted. As I said, there are two different systems for Israelis and Palestinians, and in Umm el-Khair is in a part of the West Bank which is under complete Israeli military control, which means that to build anything, to dig a well, to build an outhouse, you need permission from the Israeli authorities. That permission is almost never given, so if people just want to keep on living their lives, they have to build without seeking permits, which then gives the Israelis an excuse to come in and demolish structures whenever they want, which they do. In Umm el-Khair, this was the seventh such demolition. The other kind of demolition, which we've been seeing a return to, which Israel hadn't been doing for some time and has returned to in over this last year, are these punitive demolitions. So that if someone attempts an attack on Israeli soldiers or civilians, such as some of the stabbing attacks that have occurred in this last year, the Israeli authorities will then demolish their family's home. Palestinians tend to live, a large extended family in a single home, so it's a very big deal if your home is demolished. And the government does this supposedly as a way of deterring Palestinians from attempting any attacks on Israelis. That you'll know that your family's home will be destroyed if you do anything. It is certainly collective punishment and is certainly a violation of international law. And it's become a more and more regular occurrence. I'm guessing that the demolition you saw in Ramallah was probably one of those.
All right, let's go to Dorit in San Francisco. Hi, Dorit. Thanks for staying with us.
Yeah, hi there. From the discussion so far, I'm understanding that this is most likely not a focus of your book, but I'm curious to know if in your time living in Palestine and talking to the people, and I know Palestinians are a talkative bunch, have you talked about peace and what would the peace that they envision look like?
Yeah, of course. I think perhaps one of the largest problems is that Israelis and Palestinians have very different notions of what peace might mean. Israelis, for the most part, I think, when they think of peace, they don't want more suicide bombings. They don't want more attacks within Israel. They want to be able to live as they normally do. For Palestinians, it is a far more complicated question. I mean, first of all, it does mean that this entire system of occupation, which is a system which is designed not just to hold on to Palestinian land, but to humiliate Palestinians and sort of deprive them of the possibility of fighting at all. That has to be lifted, I think. I think people need to feel themselves free to live with dignity, free to live with the rights that people in most parts of the other parts of the planet enjoy. There are other complicated things, and people have different opinions on them. I think most people in the West Bank sorely miss, if you grew up on the West Bank and you've been growing up since the Second Intifada, since the birth of the checkpoint regimes, chances are you've never been able to go to the Mediterranean. You've never been able to go to the beach. You've never been able to go to the sea, because most West Bank Palestinians are not easily allowed into Israel.
Well, I'm glad, Ben, that we did have a chance to answer a question about peace and what that might look like, and hopefully that's a good place for us to begin to wind up. We're going to have to leave it there, but I want to make sure to mention Ben Ehrenreich, author of the book The Way to the Spring, will be at City Lights Bookstore this Thursday in San Francisco from 7 to 9. And we'll put a link to web resources at our new website, yourcallradio.org, and you can post comments there and continue this conversation. Ben, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you all for your calls and emails. I'm Renee Kemp. This is Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about Lyme disease. It's transmitted to humans through the bite of an infected tick. And each year, 300,000 Americans are diagnosed with Lyme disease. Untreated, it can cause a range of symptoms from a rash to paralysis. So how much is known about Lyme and how do you avoid getting it? Join the conversation with me, Renee Kemp, and you.
KLW's June renewal letters have just gone out. If your membership is about to expire, please take a moment to renew and join the 10,000 other listeners who provide 72% of our financial support. Send your contribution by mail or click on the donate button at kalw.org, and thank you for keeping KALW strong and independent. World Have Your Say from the BBC is coming up next. It was recorded earlier for broadcast now on your local public radio, KALW San Francisco at 91.7 FM and online at kalw.org. Your local public radio. The time is 11 o'clock.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say from the BBC World Service. We're live from Brussels and the heart of the European institutions.
My main issue with the EU is the migration and the way the EU was unable to respond to the challenge in a humane and humanitarian way.
That's Tanya with what's close to her heart. Now, she lives in Brussels, but she's from Macedonia. And this hour on the programme, you're going to meet people from Sweden, Malta, Greece, the UK, Czech Republic and Switzerland. We're going to talk about how they see the EU, how it's run and whether they think it should be reformed. Now, today I did find discussions, debates on migration, but also on Britain's referendum on the EU, border security, EU expansion. So I am interested to hear from my guests on how the EU affects them personally and what they think the big issues are. Do get in touch with us, put your questions to them. Facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay is the place to go, and we'll work them in during the programme.